Good afternoon again, everyone. Some years ago, I had an unusual experience. Well, I was substituting for a sixth grade social studies teacher who had been gone for several days. The class was studying history of the nation of Israel from Abraham through the captivity and the exile of the tribes of Israel, a period of about 1,000 years. I had three classes that each lasted for about an hour and 45 minutes. And so you can imagine I had a lot of material to cover in a fairly short time. And it was that I just stumbled into this particular timing of this class when this teacher just happened to be absent for this lesson on the history of Israel. Well, I thought this was certainly something that was going to be a delight. So I had this large class of about 36 grade students. So I was able on the whiteboard to diagram Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and then named Israel, and the 12 sons of Israel, including Joseph and Judah, and about the famine, the time in Egypt, and then because of Joseph, the prosperity that they initially had in Egypt, and then the Exodus. And we were going through all of this, and then how after the Exodus, the Ten Commandments that were written in stone, and covering also the times of King Saul, King David, and Solomon, and the building of the temple in Jerusalem, the split kingdoms, the northern in the kingdom called Israel, and the southern kingdom called Judah, and the captivities and the exiles of the two kingdoms in 105 minutes. Well, less the accommodation time it took to take attendance and to do the normal classroom disciplinary routines. And as we're going through this process and stepping through it methodically, all in their history textbook, I might add, but not from a religious perspective, but basically from a historical perspective, the students did not seem to know many, if any, of the people involved in the history of Israel. One student asked me, and I will quote, "Who in the world is Moses?" Well, so you see the amount or the lack of education that these students had, but on the other hand, they were in school there to get an education, and I was determined to help them. I asked the students if any of them could list the Ten Commandments, and many of them could name one or two of the commandments. A few students could name three or four, but that was about it. They were astounded when I wrote the numbers on the board, 1 through 10, and then filled in the blanks as they could guess what the Ten Commandments were. So they would say one out, and we'd put it in the correct place. The students were silently in awe as one student in the classroom could recite all of the Ten Commandments right down the line. However, the girl that did that only knew them in Spanish, and she couldn't say them in English. So it was a rote memory. The students were all about age 12, and so yet did not have a basic understanding of the foundation and the history of the nation of Israel. It was all new information to most of them. So those of you that want a title for today's message, you may wish to title this "The Impact of Obadiah." In preparing this, I was looking at the people in the Bible and the historical people in the Bible that were certain men that were recorded in history that made a difference. And I was looking at entitled this, and I thought, well, maybe I'll do some on the people that made a difference. And I called them the men in the middle, and I was going to think, well, maybe I'll do a series on the men in the middle. And so I looked them over. First, I thought one message, and this isn't going to work out because there's too much for each one of them. And, of course, one of them was the story of Joseph, who he learned the truth of God at an early age, and he stayed with it throughout his life. He was the son of Jacob, grandson of Isaac, great-grandson of Abraham, and so forth. And how he was rejected and cast out, sold as a slave, and became advisor to Pharaoh, and then became the regent under Pharaoh. I thought about Moses as one of the men in the middle, also a government employee at one time, who rejected the false ways of society at great risk to his own life. And then I thought about Daniel, another government employee who stayed true to his belief and trust despite of the consequences and the enemies that rose up against him, who was a captive prince of Israel that became to be a counselor to emperors, Nebuchadnezzar and Cyrus and Darius. Then I thought of Mordecai, another government employee, who turned out to be a government counselor or an employee, and despite being one of a captive people, a Benjamite, raised his cousin Esther, and the book of Esther. And then there was the case of the government employee named Cornelius, who was a Roman centurion and perhaps one of the first Gentile converts, at least recorded in the New Testament, to Christianity. And looking at those, and then there was another government employee who was ruled the country under Queen Candace, and he was not named, but he's described as the Ethiopian eunuch who responded to God's calling. And so there was a number of people who were men of God that were in government service, and they were doing the best that they could. And so the particular one that I'm going to take a look at today is a man named Obadiah. Now, in preface to that, about a dozen years ago, some of you may remember a governor elected in the state of Minnesota. You may have heard of him. He was somewhat of a maverick. His name was Jesse Ventura. He was a large man, a former professional wrestler. He was a third-party candidate who received attention far and wide after he was elected in a three-way race. Of course, Governor Ventura wasn't his real name. That was a stage name, which he later adopted. He was unpredictable. People never knew what he was going to say or do next. As a governor, he cared little for the finesse of politics, paid little regard to the attention and retention to the feelings and plans of other people. After his election, he alienated many people when he remarked that religion was a crutch for weak people. There was a joke going around at the time that the state police were normally hired as bodyguards to protect the governor from people. However, in Minnesota, the joke was that the state police were now acting as bodyguards for the people in order to protect the people from the crazy governor. Because the governor was not a member of the major parties and because he was outspoken, it was difficult for him to fill the positions in his new administration. Members of the major political parties did not want to be tainted by association with him. And so his administration chose other people who were not often involved in party politics. And that's how a church member came to be in charge of the governor's mansion. It was a responsible position that required high ethics and a strong degree of professionalism. So during the 4 years of Governor Ventura's administration, the director of the governor's mansion or the governor's household, who had many close contacts with many members of state government and knew the ins and outs of getting things done, happened to be a longtime church member. It was about 10 years ago that my daughter and I, Sina and I, had an opportunity to go north to Minnesota. We were visiting relatives in the summer in July, and I heard from a friend that some church members were gathering at the governor's mansion for a banquet. And since I knew the man who was the official in charge of the governor's mansion, I had known him for 20-some years previous because we had both lived in North Dakota at the same time. Everybody in North Dakota knows everybody else in North Dakota. It's a small population state, or as the joke goes there. And so when I heard that some church members were attending this banquet, I called him up and asked what it would take to secure some tickets. And he said, "Well, you've called the right man." He was able to get the two of us in. However, to get in, he had to personally vouch for the security of every person who was coming through the door. So we were able to get into the banquet. And the banquet was a rather simple affair. It was that served catered pizzas and ice cream. And it was set up in a garden behind the mansion. So we all got a tour of this remarkable house, a house that had been originally built by a wealthy railroad baron, Jim Hill, in the late 1800s. And, of course, he was a millionaire. He had access to the finest materials on earth to construct his house. So the bottom line was the governor had a church member who was a manager of the governor's mansion. The Bible has a record of another government official, another manager of a governor's mansion. A man who was a believer in God and who was also a member at that time of the king's court in charge of the household of a wicked king, a position much like the church member we've just discussed, in charge of the governor's household in Minnesota. That man was Obadiah, and Obadiah served at the pleasure of King Ahab, the king of the northern kingdom of Israel. The life of Obadiah is recorded in 1 Kings 18. He was a contemporary of the prophet Elijah. The name Obadiah means the servant of Jehovah. Now, it may be somewhat confusing because there's 13 different Obadiahs in the Old Testament because it's a common name. This particular one is not the fellow that wrote the prophet Obadiah, as far as we know, that's listed in the Minor Prophets. So I want to review the theme and the purpose of 1 Kings 18, because this is the story that tells much of about Obadiah's circumstances. This is the story, or the run-up to the story, of Elijah's confrontations with the priests of Baal on Mount Carmel. But first, some background. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the patriarchs, and then the sons of Jacob, or Israel, 12 tribes. Of those, one of the sons, Joseph, went to Egypt and acted as a rescuer. 430 years in Egypt, the tribes of Israel were in Egypt. Moses, and then the Exodus. They wandered in the Sinai for 40 years, received the stone tablets of the Ten Commandments. For 40 years, they got daily manna for 6 days a week to teach them reliance on God and respect of the Sabbath. Then there was the time of the judges when they went into the land of Canaan, then called the land of Israel, the promised land. And after the time of the judges were the kings of Saul and David and Solomon. And the kingdom then divided into the northern kingdom of 10 tribes and the southern kingdom of 2 tribes. So this story of events in 1 Kings 18 happens in the northern kingdom under King Ahab and Queen Jezebel, notably very wicked persons. At that time, Elijah was a prophet, and because he spoke the truth of God, Elijah wasn't well received by King Ahab. The story of Elijah the prophet is remarkable in itself, but the involvement of a government official named Obadiah was instrumental in the lessons in lessons for the everyday person when we're reading about the confrontation that Elijah had on Mount Carmel. There's a greater story at the end of the 3.5 years of drought in the land of Israel. In fact, we're going to read some of this in a moment. The confrontation on Mount Carmel between Elijah and the prophets of Baal was designed to show that drought was not merely an unfortunate circumstance or coincidence of nature, but God's discipline as the one and only true God. The rain and the end of the drought were likewise the work of God, not Baal and the so-called God of thunder, rain, and fertility. So in other words, the drought that we're going to read about was demonstrating that Baal, who was supposed to be the God of thunder and rain and fertility, simply had no power over that land. So in the process of developing this larger story and its truth, there was a number of small incidents that occurred, and each of these has its own message to tell. In other words, this is the big picture, and the main plot of the story is that Elijah confronts King Ahab. There's this confrontation on Mount Carmel. We're going to read about that. And that there's this clash between the prophets of Baal in which God decides make some classic decisions. Well, there's also the smaller stories, and as believers in Christ, we are all part of that big picture and have these smaller stories to help us with opportunities for growth. So now let's focus on Obadiah, a fellow believer of Elijah, and see what lessons that Obadiah has for us. So let's turn to 1 Kings in 18, chapter 18. We'll start in verse 1. And it came to pass after many days, 1 Kings 18, and the word of the Eternal came to Elijah in the third year, meaning the third year of the drought. Go show yourself to Ahab, and I will send rain upon the earth. Verse 2, and Elijah went to show himself to Ahab. And there was a sore famine in Samaria, and Ahab called Obadiah, which was the governor of his house. Now Obadiah feared the Eternal greatly. In other words, he respected God. He was a believer. Verse 4, for so it was when Jezebel cut off the prophets of the Eternal that Obadiah took 100 prophets. So before that, Jezebel was busy trying to kill all of the prophets of God that she possibly could, perhaps with the theory We'll get into that later, but that's what she did. That Obadiah then took on 100 prophets and hid them by 50 in a cave. In other words, he put 50 in one cave, 50 in another. And he fed them with bread and water. In other words, he provided nourishment for these prophets, hidden in a cave. And Ahab said, verse 5, to Obadiah, "Go into the land, all the fountains of water and all the brooks, peradventure that we may find grass to save the horses and mules alive, that we may not lose all the beasts." So, verse 6, they divided the land between them to pass through. In other words, certain people would look through certain parts of the country to look for grass and water. Ahab went one way by himself, and Obadiah went another way by himself. Now, this is critical because it looks how important the job was. Ahab took it upon himself to search for the water and the pasture, and he set Obadiah, a trusted governor of his, to search the land for the others. And in verse 7, "And Obadiah was in the way, and behold, Elijah met him, and he knew him," meaning Obadiah and Elijah knew each other, or Obadiah knew Elijah, "and fell on his face and said, 'Are you that, my Lord Elijah?' And Elijah answered him, and I am. Go tell your Lord, behold, Elijah is here.'" And verse 9, "And he said," this is Obadiah said, "'What, have I sinned that you would deliver your servant into the hand of Ahab to slay me?' And verse 10, 'As the Eternal your God lives, there is no nation or kingdom where my Lord has not sent to seek you,'" meaning Ahab is seeking Elijah. "'And when they said, he is not there, he took an oath of the kingdom and nation that they found you not." In other words, everyone that was searching for Elijah had to swear they really didn't find him. In verse 11, "And now you say, go tell your Lord," meaning Ahab, "behold, Elijah is here," where he is. Verse 12, "And it shall come to pass, as soon as I am gone from you, and the Spirit of the Eternal shall carry you from whither I know not. And so when I come and tell Ahab, and he can't find you, he'll slay me. But I, your servant, fear the Eternal from my youth." In other words, Obadiah was worried that, hey, I'm going to go tell Ahab you're here, and then God's going to take you somewhere else, and you'll be safe, and I'll be dead. Well, verse 13, "Was it not told my Eternal, but hey, I've believed in God since my youth." In other words, he was faithful, but he was worried. Verse 13, "Was it not told my Lord that what I did when Jezebel slew the prophets of the Eternal, how I hid 100 men of the Eternal's prophets by 50 in a cave and fed them with bread and water? And now you say, go tell your Lord," meaning Ahab, "behold, Elijah's here and he will slay me." Verse 15, "And Elijah said, as the Eternal of hosts lives, before whom I stand, I will surely show myself to him today." Meaning right now, he wasn't going to delay it or do some other time. "So Obadiah went to meet Ahab and told him, and Ahab went to meet Elijah." And verse 17, "It came to pass when Ahab saw Elijah that Ahab said to him, 'Are you he that troubles Israel?'" Well, 3.5 years had passed since Elijah had then marched up the steps of the palace, who had gone previously to the throne room of Ahab. He had announced the fact there would be no rain except by the word of the prophet, who was, of course, the mouthpiece of God. And the clouds and the rain stopped. They had been driven from the land of Israel, and then the pain and the misery had become more and more pressing. What did we have this last summer? 100 days of, or close to it, 90 days of over 90-degree temperatures, and things were pretty dry in our area. Imagine 3.5 years of drought. Ahab had searched the land and neighboring countries for Elijah, but in vain. He was angry. He was frustrated over his attempts to locate the prophet. We read that in verse 10. He was very frustrated. In other words, he made everyone who sought for him to come and take an oath that they really didn't find him. They weren't covering for him. Furthermore, Jezebel, the queen, had worked her vengeance on all the prophets of God that she could get a hold of, and killed as many as she could, as if they were Elijah's accomplices, and so that their deaths would somehow bring an end to the drought. That's in verse 4, she was thinking, that we just covered, that perhaps that if she got rid of all of God's prophets, then God's power could no longer be exercised in that land. So her desire to get revenge and crush all resistance that then drove her to kill the prophets. Well, of course, she didn't get the 100 that Obadiah was hiding in the caves and feeding 3.5 years during a drought where there was little water and little food. So weary day after weary day crept by with the sun rising and sinking on a cloudless sky over a dry land. There was no sign of relief. Ahab stayed in Samaria to attend to pressing matters caused by the drought, and Jezebel was off in a cool summer palace. In the meantime, God's word comes to Elijah and says, as we read in the beginning of chapter 18, said, Elijah, it's time to show yourself to King Ahab. It was time to demonstrate after 3.5 years that it was that the power of God, the true God, to face the nation with a decision to choose God. Therefore, in the verses that followed chapter 18, God worked it out to bring about a meeting with Ahab through another one of God's servants, which was not directly from, but it was through Obadiah. And as always the case, God works on many fronts at the same time. He wasn't just working to bring Elijah and Ahab together, but he would use Elijah in the life of Obadiah to strengthen Obadiah's faith. So let's step through this now to show the steps. We've gone through the story of how God uses and how he can use others and to bring our lives along the way. Elijah encounters Obadiah. We read that in verse 7, 1 Kings 18, verse 7. Well, Obadiah was that court official in charge of the household of the king and a steward for the king and a manager of its affairs, so he had a lot of responsibility. And he was a believer who feared God. And it was a man of faith. We read that in verse 3. Because of his faith, he had hidden those 100 prophets. And like all of us, his faith needed to have to continue to grow and mature, and for that he needed encouragement. God is in the process of stretching us beyond what we are to what we are to become more effectively for his purpose. But most of us like to stay in our comfort zones, in our little routines, which includes the places of work or our daily lives. This was the case with Obadiah. But God had other plans for him, just as he has for us. It was God's plan to use Obadiah to announce Elijah's presence to Ahab. And due to these awkward conditions, it wasn't a small challenge. So in verse 7, it says, now as Obadiah was on the way. Well, notice that he was on the job. He was on the way. He was attending to the job of the king's business. And this is life. This is where most of us are when our tests of obedience and challenges come. It's when we're out involved in the everyday affairs of life. This is where we meet people and the needs and their needs. And here is where God wants us to stretch our faith. You ever notice that those trials of life just don't come when we're all cozy and comfortable in church? We listen to inspiring hymns or stimulating messages and all those. The challenges often come when you're not being highly motivated. Tests and challenges come when we're faced in drought-like conditions with difficult personalities. And, of course, we don't all have a boss like Ahab and Jezebel, but certainly Obadiah had a terrible, terrible situation. And it's not like he could just quit the job and go work for somebody else. As he mentioned, people lost their heads if they disagreed with the king or did not take a loyalty oath. So, difficult personalities, we have temptations, the other pressures of life. So, our motivation and our courage, obedience have to come from God. We've all seen old movie strips or movies or news strips of our Marines taking the beachhead on Guadalcanal or Iwo Jima or the beaches of Normandy. And when we watch the movies, there's a band playing a song like from the Halls of Montezuma or the national anthem, and the songs then stir up the emotions within us. But in real life, there's no band in the background playing the music. It's all blood and guts. Without being properly drilled and disciplined and trained, the military men that were in those advances would have fallen apart. Well, were they scared? Well, of course. But it was their training and their mental toughness that gave them the faith and the courage to charge up those beaches. So now let's take a look at this and compare Elijah and Obadiah. They were both believers. They both loved the Word of God. They loved the Eternal. They both had served the Eternal, and they had both shown courage. It certainly took a lot of courage for Obadiah to hide 100 prophets and care for them. Secondly, Elijah had just come from a time of special preparation and solitude with the Eternal and with confirmation in the home of the widow and her son for 3.5 years. So when the call came to show himself to King Ahab, Elijah rose and went, trusting in God. His delight was to serve God and accomplish God's purpose. With Obadiah, it was different. He had been working during those 3.5 years with a lot of unbelievers, and he was living in the midst of idolatry in the household of King Ahab. We're not to be of the world, but God has called us to do the best we have when we are in the world and in the workplace in order to demonstrate God's love. And obviously, Obadiah had the trust and faith in the king because he was obviously being an honorable and responsible servant. But Obadiah had probably been without a lot of close fellowship and encouragement of other strong believers. His time with the prophets that were hidden away was undoubtedly encouraging, but likely very short and sporadic. After all, it wouldn't look too good if Obadiah were caught in the cave feeding the prophets the bread and the water. Verse 13 would suggest, and if we can look back in verse 13. In verse 13, Obadiah says, "Was it not told my Lord when I did when Jezebel slew the prophets of the Eternal, how I hid 100 men of the Eternal's prophets by 50 in a cave and fed them with bread and water?" Well, perhaps Obadiah may have been a victim of what we call the past victory syndrome. He may have been looking what he had already done for God rather than focusing on what God had done through him. Well, since God is the same yesterday, today, and forever, remembering the past can be as beneficial as long as we use it to remind us of what God is able to do today or tomorrow. Well, Obadiah wasn't really prepared for his encounter with Elijah. He was surprised. But he was open and positive, and then he becomes one of God's chosen instruments in this drama that helps prepare the way for Elijah and Mount Carmel. But first, Obadiah needed the encouragement of Elijah. And this illustrates our need to encourage one another and to lift us up for the challenge that we face. If you look in the next verse, let me find the verse. Verse 14. Just a moment. Oh, here we go. Verse 7, I'm sorry. In verse 7, it says, "As Obadiah was in the way, behold, Elijah met him." Well, that phrase, "behold, Elijah met him," the word "behold" is here for a reason. This is the word, Hebrew word, hinna, which is an interjection. It's an exclamation that's used 942 times in the Old Testament to arrest attention or call attention. It means look or see. In Japan, I kept hearing this expression in the railway stations. Sumimasen, sumimasen. And then it would keep going with other comments that I couldn't understand. When I was in a restaurant, I would see a patron saying, sumimasen, sumimasen, and a waiter would come over and call on them. From time to time, when somebody would call out to someone else, they would say, sumimasen, sumimasen. It was a repeated word. It was an interjection. It meant, look, you know, excuse me, please. I have something to say or something to show you. It was an expression. This is similar to what we have in the word behold here, which used to point out something and to emphasize the information that follows. So what is so important was the fact that Elijah met Obadiah while he was on his way, meaning out doing his job, and then he was interrupted. It was like saying, sumimasen, sumimasen. In other words, behold, stop. There's something interesting here. There's something that that I need to point out. And in verse 7, it was, "Behold, Elijah met him." In other words, it was a surprise at that time. So because Elijah, Obadiah was surprised, Elijah was in hostile territory. He didn't expect to come across, Obadiah didn't expect to come across Elijah at that time. So Elijah didn't have to try to go all the way into the capital, into Samaria, to meet King Ahab. God told him to go meet the king, and here's the king's governor right there in front of him right along the way. And it was a faith, happened to be a faithful follower of God that just happened to meet there. Well, we say it just happened, but of course, this was not by mere chance. There's a story of a Captain Johnson who was serving as a chaplain in the South Pacific during World War II. He and the rest of the men in his group were going on a bombing raid over an enemy-occupied island hundreds of miles away. The mission was a complete success, their bombing mission, but on the homeward course, the plane began to lose altitude, and the engines faded out. A safe landing was made on a beach on a strange island, but they sent out men and found out that the enemy was only a half a mile in each direction. And yet, for some reason, because of the noise and the wind, their landing had gone on undetected. The staff sergeant came to the chaplain and said, "Chaplain, you've been telling us for months in the need of praying and believing God's answers. God answers prayer in time of trouble. And he that does it, and he that does it needs to do it right away, because we're out of gas. The base is several hundred miles away on another island, and we're surrounded by enemy." Well, Chaplain Johnson began to pray and asked for the promises of God to be delivered, that God would work a miracle. Well, nighttime came, and the chaplain continued with his intense prayer. And about 2 a.m., a sergeant awakened, and he felt compelled to walk to the water's edge. He discovered a metal float, which had drifted up, like a raft, had drifted up on the beach. And he discovered that on this metal raft, floating raft, were barrels and barrels of airplane fuel. In a few hours, the crew had rolled the barrels off, refueled their plane, took off on the beach, and were home safely. Upon the investigation as to whatever happened, there was a skipper of a U.S. tanker ship. Finding out that his tanker ship was in sub-infested waters, had his fuel cargo removed from the ship so as to minimize the danger in case a torpedo hit the tanker ship. He placed the barrels on barges and he put them adrift 600 miles away from where Johnson and the plane crew were forced down. Well, one of those barges made it through the wind and the current and beached it 50 steps from the stranded men. Sometimes things work out, and it reminds us of God's loving care, that if God sends us to do a job, he'll provide the resources that we need to finish the job. So if we go on after verse 7, it says, Obadiah recognized him and fell on his face. Well, that's, in other words, Obadiah recognized Elijah. In the book of Revelation, when the apostle John fell on his face before the angel, at the announcement of the marriage feast of the Lamb, the angel said, "Don't do that. I'm a fellow servant of yours and your brethren. Worship God." We find that in Revelation 19, verse 10. And it's repeated again in Revelation 22 and 8 and 9. John's actions fell in the realm of worship for the angel because of the revelation. But Elijah didn't correct Obadiah, because it was merely a cultural sign of respect for the prophet as a man of God. And with the word of God fulfilling the mission of God, since Obadiah called the man his master, this may have indicated that Obadiah perhaps was a member of the school of prophets or one of those who Elijah had been teaching as the headmaster. So it was a term of reverence or recognition of Elijah's leadership within Israel. Then, in verse 8, Elijah calls for Obadiah's help. You know, as those World War II airmen saw the barge of oil as a godsend, so Elijah obviously saw Obadiah as a godsend. Here was the perfect person. Obadiah was the perfect person to send word to King Ahab. But it doesn't say that Elijah prayed for a miracle. There's no record of it. No, he may have. He didn't ask God to give the king Ahab a vision to come and meet him. He just used the means and opportunities that God had sent his way, which perhaps is a lesson for us, that we should use the means and opportunities that God sends our way. So this is a principle of getting help from people according to their training, their gifts, their talents, opportunities, and, of course, their availability. Sometimes we'll see here that it takes encouragement and biblical insight from us or the promise of our aid and faithfulness for God to be able to use us. Next is Obadiah. How does Obadiah respond? We read that in verses 9 through 14. And he responds with fear and excuses. One of the things that we face is fear or anxiety when we often face what we're asked to consider certain responsibilities. And we often face the problem of fear. We might be afraid of what we lack to do what it takes to handle the job. We might be afraid of what it may cost us, maybe afraid of we'll have to give up our time, our comfort, or the things we love to do. In Obadiah's case, he had many of these fears as what was going to happen to him. In times of real persecution, serving God can be life-threatening as it was for Obadiah. For most of us, our fears generally fall into three categories. The fear of failure, the fear of rejection, and the fear of loss. We might fear that we have to give up something. We think we have to have. Well, the cost of this fear then of rejection can be maybe somebody will snub us, or having people that think that we're odd or that we're dumb, or perhaps we're afraid to lose our job or your way of life, or in Ahab's in Obadiah's case, he thought he would lose his life. Fear can paralyze us or neutralize us. It can keep us from venturing out and being available to God. And this was happening to Obadiah. But we have a mighty God who's promised to stand with us so we can overcome our fears. We're told in 2 Timothy 2, in chapter 1, in verse 7. In 2 Timothy 2, in chapter 1, and verse 7. For God has not given us a spirit of timidity, which is fear. In 2 Timothy 1, verse 7, God has not given us a spirit of timidity or fear, but of the power of love and discipline, which is a sound mind, is another translation. We need the encouragement of others. This happened here, what Elijah gave to Obadiah. We need the power of God's spirit in our lives. We need the love that's willing to sacrifice for God and others. And we need the discipline of a sound mind for relying on the promises and principles in the Scripture. Obadiah's thinking was undermining his ability to respond to Elijah's request. Obadiah was thinking this was going to be a bad news deal. And it shows us how we need to bring our thoughts into captivity, how do we deal with the situations that come along. Sometimes there's a misconception about trials or difficult assignments. Obadiah saw this difficult assignment as God's punishment for sin. If you take a look in verse 9, he said, "What, have I sinned that you would deliver your servant into the hand of Ahab to slay me?" So his first thought was, "I'm being punished for my sins." And of course, we all have sinned, and Obadiah knows his own sins better than any other human would know. So I'm thinking, well, this is it. The jig's up. I mean, I'm toast. I will have one function and then I'll be snuffed out. But we have to look beyond that to what God expects of us. Then Obadiah had a misdirection of his focus. Even though he was a believer in God, Obadiah was looking on the problems instead of on God to deliver him from the problem. And sometimes that focus, when we focus only on the problem, makes the mountain out of a molehill. and in our own perspective reduces God's thoughts to just God to the molehill and we are the mountain. It's the it's also a problem that Obadiah may have had a mismanagement of his own mind. He failed to control his thoughts or thought patterns. He let them run wild. That we are to bring every thought into captivity. So when we fail to focus on God's person and claim God's promises, as Obadiah, we start assuming all kinds of things about what's going to happen, or what is going to happen, what is happening, or what can happen, and we can become paranoid. Obadiah imagined that Elijah was going to disappear, and he would see himself hanging from the gallows. If we look, go on to verse 10 or verse 12, at 1 Kings. When we see that, Obadiah says in verse 12, 1 Kings 18, "And it shall come to pass, as soon as I'm gone from you, that the Spirit of the Eternal shall carry you someplace I don't know, where I don't not. And so when I come and tell Ahab, and he cannot find you, he shall slay me." So he was worried that, hey, things aren't going to turn out just as easily as you've suggested. So his mind was becoming very concerned. He let his mind run away. It wasn't under control. So Ahab had so long and so systematically sought for Elijah for those 3.5 years that Obadiah could only imagine that the prophet had been miraculously removed, perhaps from shelter to shelter, home to home, just in time to save him from being detected. Sort of like Saddam Hussein was moved from place to place and trying to hide from being caught, or the most recent dictator to meet his demise in Libya was moving literally from house to house, from day to day, and sometimes more than one per day, until Gaddafi met his end. And so that's what appears what Obadiah was thinking, is that Elijah was always one step ahead of the searchers. And of course, we know that it wasn't the case that Elijah was in a safe place for those 3.5 years. And so too often, are we in the habit of looking for things then that are strange or miracles or something odd that this is the only explanation, when a very ordinary explanation. I recall, wasn't that long ago, I was in a class at university in a statistics class, and one of the students brought up what they call Occam's razor, which is a fellow named Occam. Developed a saying that has become a principle that says, when faced with many complicated decisions or choices for solutions to a problem, the simplest one is most often the correct one. In other words, choose the simple answer. Don't go for the most complex one. Well, I don't know that Occam's razor was not yet stated at the time of Obadiah, but he was looking for all the complicated things. Couldn't imagine that Elijah was just safe and sitting there. Now let's read what Elijah did in verse 15, in 1 Kings 18 and verse 15. Elijah helped to remove Obadiah's fear by calling on the power of God. And he does this, and we can read this in his words in verse 15. And Elijah said, "As the Eternal of hosts live, before whom I stand, I will surely show himself unto him today." In other words, he starts out with saying, "As the Lord of hosts lives." In other words, Elijah was convinced of the aliveness and the power of God. In other words, as surely as that. And that was as sure as you could get. That was positive. In other words, it's really going to happen. And he was explaining that just as much as we believe in God, and we know it to be true, that's what he was going to base his actions on for that day. So by this, Elijah was focusing on, by focusing on putting Obadiah's eyes on God and assuring him that his own life was safe in that sense, because he could rely on God. And then you see that in the words, "before whom I stand," in that same verse 15, "as the Lord of hosts lives, before whom I stand." Here Elijah is assuring Obadiah that Obadiah was okay. He was one of God's people, and he stood to serve the Eternal and not just himself. And that believers need to give evidence that they're under God's orders, that they're at his disposal. So in other words, before whom I stand, in other words, showing I'm under the authority of God. In other words, and by implication, so are you, Obadiah. In other words, I am. I'm standing before God, and so are you. And then, so by that, Elijah is pointing to Obadiah's calling, his commitment to honor God. And then we follow in that verse 15. It says, I will surely show myself to him today. Meaning Elijah said he was assuring Obadiah that Elijah would make contact with King Ahab that day. He was saying, I'm not going to let you down. I'm making this commitment. It's going to happen. And the emphasis here is you can count on me because I am counting on God. Obadiah knew then that from the life and history of the prophet of Elijah, that Elijah could be counted on. Faithfulness is a needed quality. And that faithfulness comes from a product life full of faith and reliance on God. So now we look at verse 16 and we read about how Obadiah responds. And he responds then with courage. And in verse 16, part of Obadiah's anxiety was caused by the fact he wasn't sure of God's will or what was going on, and he needed the motivation of Elijah's leadership through example and encouragement of the prophet. So in verse 16, so Obadiah went to meet Ahab and told him, and Ahab went to meet Elijah. So it doesn't say Obadiah continued to complain and whine and fuss and moan and groan of all the reasons why he couldn't possibly do it and how it will never work, because Elijah told him, I will surely show myself to him today. And he was saying, we're servants of God. We're standing before God. So what did Obadiah do? He went and did it. He went to meet Ahab and told him directly. Ahab wasn't worried about meeting Obadiah. That was his governor of his household. And he could speak truthfully because Obadiah could speak honorably to Ahab and say, I met Elijah and he wants to meet you today. And here he is. Which had to be quite a shock for Ahab as well. We vary in our leadership roles, but there's a sense in which we each have some kind of influence on other people or on other believers. And we are as salt or as light to others, to everyone else in our life, and everybody needs some encouragement to those around us. As we see in this passage, God wants us to be sensitive to the needs and to be examples by demonstrating the reality of Christ and being authentic Christians. In 1 Thessalonians 5, in verse 11, I want to call attention to 1 Thessalonians 5 and verse 11. And I'll find it soon. Therefore, let's see. This happens when your bookmark comes out. Wherefore, comfort yourselves together and edify one another, even as also you do. So, in other words, encouraging each other, building up each other, as you are doing, could have been coming right out of the results of what Elijah told Obadiah, to encourage him to say, look, we both stand before God. We're both working for, the same God. And so he had to encourage him to relieve some of his fears and to move on. So what are, you know, some of those lessons from the life of Obadiah. is that we need to respond with courage when we're faced with a circumstance. We need to understand the trial or difficult assignments and not have misconceptions about them. We need to be directed on our focus. We need to manage our mind. We need to have a proper placement of confidence or faith. We need to point to the commitment or the call that God has given us, and we need to call on the power of God. The There was a Cherokee grandfather, an old fellow, who was talking about the battle that goes on inside of all of us. And he was telling his grandson, "My son, the battle of life is between two wolves inside each of us. One wolf is evil. It is anger, it's envy, it's jealousy, it's sorrow, it's regret. It's evil, it's arrogance, self-pity, guilt, resentment, inferiority, lies, false pride, superiority, and ego. The other wolf is good. It's joy, peace, love, hope, serenity, humility, kindness, benevolence, empathy, generosity, truth, compassion, and faith." So the young grandson thought about it for a while and asked his grandfather, "Which wolf wins the battle?" And the old Cherokee grandfather replied, "The one you feed." And so in this case, Obadiah was reminded to feed the good wolf and not to feed the bad wolf, as in the Cherokee saying, and you could probably recognize the two different wolves as the fruits of the spirit and the works of the flesh. So Obadiah was reminded although he was a believer in God, he needed that encouragement, and he was reminded to feed the good wolf in that sense. So we will have responsibilities every day to carry out in an ungodly world, and we will have decisions to make, just like Obadiah. We can't rest on our past efforts, even though we may wish to call attention to them, like Obadiah did. We must choose to make those godly decisions every day. And like the Cherokee proverb, let's feed the right wolf.